This one's going out to Jen Applefern. You know who you are, trash to treasure vixen.
That's good.
All right, that was Aphrodite, who's playing tomorrow night at the Fluid. And if you're a late night parent, or you're a parent and a family staying up late together to listen to Fane of the Cosmos, you've got school tomorrow. School alert, there will be school tomorrow, so you better get to bed. You can't stay up late tonight. You do have to go to school tomorrow. And we're continuing with our series, with the flashback series, commemorating 5 years of quality broadcasting on Kootenai Co-op Radio. This is Fane of the Cosmos from 2002, April 4th. Here we go.
In terms of your workshop, I would imagine that depending on where you're doing it, you'll get different degrees of sexual hying up and having in different approaches that you have to bring to couples or individuals who come to your workshops. Is that true, or is there like a broad general North American sexual hying up thing that you have to deal with?
Well, you know, the healthier it is, the healthier the person coming, then the easier it is to move. You know, so I wouldn't say that I'm there to deal with a great deal of dysfunction. You know, if people have walls in front of them of problems, then my general approach is, you know, how high is the wall? Because this is how high you have to jump right now to see over it. Mm. Rather than trying to take the wall apart. Mm. So I'm kind of take the approach beyond therapy, really. So, and nothing in it, in breath work or in the things that we'll do, would aggravate any problems. In that sense, it's harmless. But you may have a view of something. You know, so as you raise energy in your body, you may have a view. You know, a kundalini experience, for instance, where a powerful energy rushes through, it can seem to be dangerous, but in the 20, 30 years of group work that I've done, inevitably there's a way to earth that and then to come back, and you've had a view. You've climbed the mountains like you've climbed Everest, and you've had a view over the wall of your problems. So the smaller that wall, the easier it is to work. And I do like to do, before a group, put out some questions and a questionnaire so that people can work through some things before they come. That way there's a kind of a screening in a sense, because there's a self-screening. And if people have really serious problems, then really that's a place really for therapy rather than the group. I take the view that, you know, we start from a pretty healthy place, really, or a healthy attitude at least. And then from that, then we can start to explore. So I don't see that the things that we do here are necessarily, you know, therapy. I mean, the old Zen technique for somebody with problems, really all problems, was to put them in a room with mirrors for 3 weeks and say, well, look at that. And they would look at themselves, and that's not really what I want to do in a workshop like this. Inevitably, things come up, and, you know, I've seen almost everything in the years I've worked with sexuality. But there's usually a place to see above your problem, and that's really what you want when you get up to another level. I mean, I always remember when I was in this profoundly aggravating situation of arguing with a girlfriend for many, many years, and finally, in one great argument, I really saw above the wall of our arguments, and it didn't matter whether I was right or wrong anymore. I got to another energetic level, and so trying to get that view, I think, is the main purpose here.
Yeah, it's
looking
not
above your problems.
So that this workshop isn't like sexual gymnastics or contortion.
No,
it's energy.
No, no, no.
It's all about energy. And
it's about energy and being able to facilitate that.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I like the Taoist approach. I mean, most yoga these days, if you go to a yoga class, you feel like you're in the Olympics.
Yeah, the contortion, the sexual contortion.
And in fact, most of the Hindu scriptures and things came from that kind of sexual gymnastics point of view. You know, that's why this much more relaxed view that the Taoists had, you know, they kind of take the view, for instance, even in their exercise program, that you're a baby born between the sky and the earth, and that's how you should be. Take this breath like a baby, you know, just be natural and open. And I really like this relaxed approach, especially when we're dealing with sexuality.
Yeah, we kind of need that in the West, to kind of more of a gentle, more gentler sexual experience, because the one that our culture feeds us is this kind of flesh-pounding steam engine that, you know, all you're trying to do is race to the end of the track and leap off the edge of the cliff without any energy cultivation, just a kind of head-on collision.
Exactly.
It seems that the product orientation of Western sexuality towards the focus on the orgasm as opposed to the infinite moment of the sexual union seems to be a major problem in the West. That seems to be almost a reflection of Western pornography in terms and now, is there like a I would say like a almost a deprogramming that has to go on here in terms of introducing
people to concept?
Well, we
could go deeply into that. I think, you know, a lot has to do with letting the women lead, you know, and giving over a lot of the energy towards the woman instead of it being this, you know, this goal-oriented achieving place. It's, in one sense, it's moving back into refinement and tenderness and kindness to a large degree, and allowing energy to flow. I mean, clearly there's cultivation that one can do and exercises that one can do. You know, toning is good, you know, whether you're trying to sing better or whatever you're doing, you know, there's a certain toning to do. But in terms of a goal to be achieved, you know, like I have to make love for the next 2 hours, or, you know, I can't have an orgasm, or there should be no ejaculation, or whatever, you know, there's a view towards this with more poetry and humor. I mean, it's actually an art, I would suggest, rather than this, you know, kind of elaborate goal-orientated view, really. And that's why I want to approach this, as I say, more from this Taoist viewpoint.
Yeah, the thing for me that really kind of brought it home was the amount of energy we spend, our bodies spend, creating sexual energy, creating sperm, and creating... You know, I can't remember what the figure was, but I think 2/3 of our energy goes towards that production and for that. So for us not to cultivate that, for us to just lose that energy having sex or having sexual relations, then we're actually losing out on our life energy. And
well,
the idea to kind of build it up, that it's a key to our health and our...
Well, that was a lot of the Taoist view, was to cultivate that chi. You know, and there's some very interesting statements from some of the Chinese teachers on that. And, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said. I mean, I wouldn't say abstinence, really, but pacing. I mean, you know, the male is most potent up until the age of 18. And then
don't say this. No.
Afterwards, it's cultivation.
It's cultivation time.
So, you know, what you're doing with that sperm is pretty important. I mean, I know in my own life, I have You know, definitely. You know, I have dates with my wife, and we really look at these things. She's an acupuncturist and a Tai Chi teacher and things. So we look at this, you know, quite deeply, and it seems to work. We seem to stay pretty healthy. And so this view about health and longevity that comes from the Taoist point of view is an interesting, simple way to look at this, rather than getting too involved into the higher mysteries, in a sense. If we can start with that healthy attitude, then the higher mysteries will kind of reveal themselves.
Now, I would imagine you're probably not going to be covering this in the course, but part of the theme of the Fane of the Universe Infinite Moment is open and frank discussions on sexuality, but also on the sacrament of psychedelics and such.
Ah, uh-huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so we talk about ayahuasca, psilocybin.
Sure.
You know, all those. Now, what, you know, like, what do you think the best psychedelic is for this sort of sexuality, or what would tend, or what?
Well, you know, I think it's different for, I think it's different medicines have different functions, really. I mean, I always find with medicine journeys that your intention is always such a strong indicator. I mean, I remember wanting to know something once about some friends that were dead, and you know, ayahuasca was the plant that wanted to answer those questions, you know. And I think also it depends a lot on the chemistry of the person involved. For myself, I think the cactus is actually
like the San Pedro.
San Pedro, for instance, I think is a very, you know, body orientated, heart orientated. I would suggest those more than the mushrooms and things. But you know, for instance, have you ever heard of ibogaine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ibogaine is a, you know, that can be a very, very powerful sexual stimulant, but it's kind of a male. Feels like a male energy, something you want to dance on and get, you know, get to feel that male power running through you, which may then lead you to some kind of communion with the female universe around you.
Hmm.
You know, so I think if you're in a male body, ibogaine might be something, but in a female body, which I'm not, I'm not sure what it would be. But medicine journeys are very interesting. To combine those with sexuality, some work that has not really been done.
Hmm.
You know, I know good teachers in terms of sexuality, and I know good teachers in terms of medicine, and I have never really seen the two combined.
Well, there's kind of like in the Mantak Chia, he says that any kind of intoxicant or inebriant or psychedelic interferes with the cultivation of the chi. But
I mean, I think we're built for oxygen.
Yeah.
You know, I think oxygen is the drug of choice, really. And if we can work with that oxygen, I mean, we did that once, actually. We did a kind of an experimental group with a bunch of friends that I'd had around in the Tantra world for a long time, and we tried to do some vision work just using oxygen and sexuality, because these people from Los Angeles, and they were into taking, you know, they're taking a lot of ayahuasca and things like that. And we just set up a whole ceremony where we were just using breath and powerful, you know, sexual energy, and trying to vision and journey on that. And it worked well, and the things that happen on
Well, we're experiencing some technical difficulties. Just one second here.
Here we go. Come on. Okay, I'm not sure what's going on here. Okay, folks, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take it out of the one CD player here. And I'm going to put it in to the other CD player. I'm going to press play, and then I'm going to do that crazy skipping thing that you heard earlier. And we'll guide it back to where we were here. So I'm just going down here, slowly, slowly, roly-poly. I'm not sure what happened there. This disc, of course, is from 2002, so maybe there were some technical difficulties there, I don't know, but I had listened to it earlier today, so I know it's good. I'll just wind it down here to the right zone. Here we go. Okay, there we go. It won't play. That's so weird. Okay, here. I'm gonna try something else here. Heck is going, oh, there we go. He's looking at the disc. He sees some extreme finger marks on there. So I must just be freaking out a little, going, why is Dusty's fingerprints on here? Okay, here we go. Come on. Don't leave me now. Don't leave me now. You're listening to the inside. Oh no, what am I doing? See, I had it on, there we go. Okay, here we go. Okay, now I'm gonna do the crazy thing. Okay, this is a flashback. We're flashing back right now. Picture yourself on LSD. You've been listening to the show. You don't know what's happening. All you know is the voices in your head. They're coming. You're not sure what's going on. Oh my god. I'm freaking out. Nij nor na hish no con ti mokota shiko to go maiki shing do hai monk toy ha shiki to makai shiko to hamani ni shiko to go. Here we go. Come on. The heck? That won't play at all. Come on, darling.
I think it's different medicines have different functions, really. I mean, I always find with medicine journeys that your intention is always such a strong indicator. I mean, I remember wanting to know something once about some friends that were dead. And you know, ayahuasca was the plant that wanted to answer those questions, you know. And I think also it depends a lot on the chemistry of the person involved. For myself, I think the cactuses actually,
like the San Pedro.
The San Pedro, for instance, I think is a very, you know, body orientated, heart orientated. I would suggest those more than the mushrooms and things. But, you know, for instance, have you ever heard of ibogaine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ibogaine is, that can be a very, very powerful sexual stimulant. But it's kind of a male feels like a male energy, something that you want to dance on and get, you know, get to feel that male power running through you, which may then lead you to some kind of communion with the female universe around you.
Hmm.
You know, so I think if you're in a male body, evil game might be something, but in a female body, which I'm not, I'm not sure what it would be, but medicine journeys are very interesting. To combine those with sexuality, some work that has not really been done.
Hmm.
You know, I know good teachers in terms of sexuality, and I know good teachers in terms of medicine, and I have never really seen the two combined.
Well, there's kind of, like in the Mantak Chia, he says that any kind of intoxicant or inebriant or psychedelic interferes with the cultivation of the chi. But
I mean, I think we're built for oxygen.
Yeah.
You know, I think oxygen is the drug of choice, really. And if we can work with that oxygen, I mean, we did that once, actually. We did a kind of an experimental group with a bunch of friends that I've had around in the Tantra world for a long time, and we tried to do some vision work just using oxygen and sexuality, because these people from Los Angeles, and they're into taking, you know, they're taking a lot of ayahuasca and things like that, and we just set up a whole ceremony where we were just using breath and powerful, you know, sexual energy, and trying to vision and journey on that. And it worked well, and the things that happen.
Okay, here we go again. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to see if I can't get it to roll. Come on. Oh, man. Technical difficulties here. I don't know what happened there. Okay, we're going to go to the other CD, part two.
Give me that. Other times it's this Irish elfin band thing where they come literally tiptoeing through the tulips, you know, and you hear it far off, like the tinkling of bells, and then it just gets louder and louder and nearer, and then you see it, and then it's around you. And it's, you know, like that's, like, well, it's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon directed by Tristan Zara or something like that. I mean, it's quite zany, unpredictable. The thing that always impressed me about psychedelics was the way in which it could convince you that you could never think of this, you know, and that was the stamp of authenticity, the fact that it was moving faster than your own imagination, astonishing you, making you laugh, frightening you, leading you on, teasing you. It's very strange. I mean, there's nothing else like it. It's like, you know, the Arabs used to say of the city of Isfahan in Iran in the 10th century that it was half the world, because of its vaulted domes and minarets, that if you hadn't seen Isfahan, half the world lay before you. Well, it's literally true of psychedelics. I mean, half at least of the world lies over yonder in these strange dimensions. And they're not inaccessible. You know, they're very accessible. You don't have to spend 20 years around the ashram. And yet, my goodness, we maintain decorum around them and to don't break protocol and behave ourselves in the presence of it. I mean, even those of us who are supposed experts or accounted great explorers of it spend nine times as much time talking about it as doing it, you may be sure. So, you know, it's just a kind of a cultural blind spot, seeming to a person like myself very important, to someone else extraordinarily trivial. I mean, there was even a book published on the drug problem recently called America's Great Drug War by Locke, Treadwell. Treadwell, who's a good guy. He wants legalization. He's a good guy. But there's no entry for psychedelic drugs, no entry for LSD, no entry for mescaline. It's not what they're talking about, not what they're worrying about. Even the people who want drugs legalized do it with this kind of, okay, you know, this attitude. We're defeated. We'll legalize drugs. Screw it. That's it. Go ruin yourselves now. There's no notion of hope, no notion of a pharmacological engineering of consciousness to any reasonable end. It's just, you know, if you're not willing to go it alone with God's grace, well, then you're just consigned to the road to hell. Yeah.
I have some friends that have used MDMA with ketamine and 2CB, and I was wondering if anyone had used that. I'm sure someone has used it with mushrooms, but that's crazy if you'd heard.
MDMA with mushrooms? Let me see if I can remember. I can't really remember anybody specifically doing that. All these things get done. I sort of try to warn people off of these things, and I'm a terrible...
friends that have been in the world for a long time, and we try to do some vision work just using oxygen and sexuality.
Okay, we're trying CD number 3.
People from Los Angeles, and they're into taking, they're taking a lot of ayahuasca and things like that. And we just set up a whole ceremony where we were just using breath and powerful, sexual energy, and trying to vision and journey on that. And it worked well, and the things that happen...
No. Continue with Terrence McKenna on Fan of the Cosmos. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicooperadio.com. We had experienced some technical difficulties there. Hopefully I'll be able to splice or dice or download the rest of that interview, and we can play that, because it's a really awesome interview. I'm not exactly sure what happened with the CD, but I'm sure there's some technophilic elf out there who will help me download it all. Here we go with Terrence McKenna.
Combination of ecstasy and mushrooms.
How was that?
Well, I felt that right away that the mushroom was felt sullied.
Sullied.
I was sullied by, I felt I violated this relationship, because I had cultivated this relationship with the mushroom, and I said, what is this doing here?
Who is this cheap trollop that you dragged in?
It wasn't pleasant, because they both were at odds, and it was just an energy block.
Yeah, synergies are a sort of unexplored area because there are so many of them. You all understand synergies are what happens when you rub two drugs or more together. And very weird things happen, but they're not very controllable or repeatable. What I always say to people about choosing drugs and strategies for bringing drugs into your life and your program of spiritual development or self-exploration or whatever is the most interesting drugs are the ones that occur in plants. That the occurrence of a drug in a plant shows that it has a certain affinity to organic life. But that doesn't mean that there aren't hellacious toxins in some plants. I mean, there's curare, there's strychnine, there's cyanide. These are plant byproducts as well. But nevertheless, as a first pass, it's important that a compound occur in a plant. Well, then the next thing is, does it have a history of human usage? And the interesting ones almost all do. Psilocybin, used in Mexico for millennia, other parts of the world, it's probably for a very long time, although the evidence is less clear. Peyote has a long history of usage in the American Southwest. Cannabis goes back millennia, so does opiate use. So then, do these things have a history of human usage and even specifically shamanic usage? And then, to my mind, the really interesting question, do they have an affinity to ordinary brain chemistry? Do they, because... And I mentioned this morning, the strongest drugs are the ones most like ordinary brain chemistry. The most extreme case being DMT. DMT only lasts 7 to 10 minutes, and yet it's the most profound dislocation of reality that you can undergo. Well, why is it that it is both so profound and so quickly quenched in the organism? It's because in the human brain, bile pathways exist which recognize and degrade this very readily because they are there all the time performing this function, DMT. So to my mind, you know, it isn't that you sail out toward the most synthetic or complex or chelated molecules, but that in fact these things are highly suspect. That what we're trying to do is actually tweak consciousness, do reverence to the physical brain, but tweak consciousness as little as possible to get the desired effect. One of the really fascinating things about DMT, I think, is that once someone has smoked it, once someone has had this experience, you can have a dream in which it is introduced into the dream as a theme, DMT, and then you actually smoke it in the dream and it actually happens in the dream. And I don't know of any other drug that this is true of. And it's what it says to me is that even though this is an extremely radical psychedelic experience, apparently the chemistry that is the precondition for it is just under the surface, almost within reach of conscious awareness. I mean, I've sat down at times and thought about smoking DMT and tried to invoke it and never succeeded the way I've succeeded in a lucid dream doing that. But it shows, I think, that the chemistry is very close to ordinary metabolism.
I'm interested in that. It's not the same thing as mushrooms,
Yes, it's closely related in the chemical families of the hallucinogens. You have the indole family, which is a fairly large family, and it includes the lysergamides that are the LSD type drugs, the beta carbolines, which are MAO inhibitors and occur in Banisteriopsis caapi, and the iboga alkaloids, which are psychedelic aphrodisiacs from West Africa, and then the tryptamine group. And the tryptamine group is the largest, and it comprises psilocybin in the mushroom and DMT in the leaves of certain bushes and in the certain South American trees. And then
Terence McKenna and the world of psychedelics out there.
You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM, the dark side of radio. So, any of you out there, you may not know it, but the Eco Center is down to $7. In their bank account. So everybody who has valued the Eco Center, get over there. Gotta give them help them out. That's a pretty rough place to be. They've been here 8 years, I think.
They're down to $7.
Down to $7.
It seems to be rough for everyone right now.
Yeah,
I was just talking to a friend tonight who on the coast she gets paid for stuff. Here it's all trade. Nobody has money. But yeah. It's a few years ago I thought that the perfect sort of artist run economy would be like based on not the gold standard or the Egyptian grain standard, but on the hemp standard. And because economies have to have that sort of that's redeemable thing that people can believe that one kootenai buck is going to be worth one kootenai buck, right, based on a marijuana standard.
I remember the first time I saw that was on these incense from the island, where on the inside cover of the incense there was a stamp and it said the hemp standard, 1 hour equals $10 equals 1 gram, in a circle around the edge, and the inside said the hemp standard. And I was like, it was like subversively put under this cover, and I was like, yes, you know,
yeah,
that's
the
economy.
I made that stamp.
No,
yeah,
Ian Hunter, get
Seriously.
Out.
Yeah, yeah.
Except I thought it could add one thing on there. Hemp equals 1 hour equals $10 equals 1 barter buck.
Well, and it goes on. You know, equals ten pounds of viable hemp seed equals, you know, blah blah blah, you know, it becomes an equivalent standard. And but yeah, I stamped all my money like that, especially Mackenzie King 50s. And then on the other side, I had Disgrace This Man, He Started Prohibition, as a stamp over him. And then if you looked at it through a light, then you would see superimposed on the other side, you'd see the hemp standard.
Around his head like a halo?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
no,
with a hemp standard in the background, because he started the Banking Act and such like that. But so I was proposing the green zone system, where on a community level basis, you'd have the hemp standard, and if we all agree that okay, the basis of our trading economy here in Nelson is this, but the problem is surfacing with something that's illegal. Like, would the American troops see this as an excuse to come over the border suddenly if we convince the local credit union to take our otherwise unsellable pounds of pot and put it into the safety deposit box openly, like as a protected thing? In a reasonable sense, they should be able to do that. You know, but it's like there's such a fear surrounding this that the actual basis behind liberated and open white marketed community standard issue hemp standard would do it, but it's doable. And and so that's kind of one of the things that it was like gently pushing, you know, like is the hemp standard through the hemp standard stamp. I wanted to get it out. In fact, on the cultivation game, I have the hemp standard there as well. But if you look at I'm on the $10 bill of the cultivation game, it has the hemp standard, $10 equals 1 hour on that. And so it's like a subversive slip into the mindscape, you know, maybe it's the butterfly wing of a thought going out there that some future Marxian individual will go, yes, that's it, just like the Egyptians had their grain standard, we can have our hemp standard, and if only we wake up like Emperor Norton and believe that reality has changed and take our 10 pounds of unsold pot because it can't sell because of the American border down to the Royal Bank and plunk it on the counter and go, okay, can you put this in your safety, can you take this in? They would call you mad. They might, it would be such an ontological shock if somebody walked in with like
to the bank
ten,
and just
to the bank and
a
just
bunch
like laid
of bonds down, so, right down.
Well, what's wrong with you? It's hemp standard. Come on, you know, you can explain hemp standard. And don't you take it? Everybody else does, you know.
Yeah.
And who knows? You know, would they call the police? Would they throw you in the Trail Mental Hospital for doing that, or would they go, I'll ask my manager, you know, which is probably what they would do. And the manager would confer with the assistant manager, and they would laugh and scratch their heads and debating whether to call the police or not, you know, and such like that, you know, and because this is a legitimate, you know.
But your buddy would go, hey, wow, man, that's a quarter pound of some nice herb. Well, I can fix your car, or check out these root vegetables I got.
Well, exactly. Straight society can't deal with it. But if you have some, like, understood equivalent, then it could be the basis of a barter-style economy. It's doable. It's very doable. But would it be a criminal conspiracy, or would it be a political act? Would it
you
be
know
both?
What? It could be.
It'd be a revolutionary act.
It could
act.
Be considered conspiracy to overthrow the economic power of Canada. Remember, they added that in.
Well, really? Well, if you have it as like a complementary currency, then how could that be possible, though?
If you were to hurt. Remember, there's some, I can't remember the exact wording of it. Something like to willfully try to damage the economic stability of Canada, you know?
Well, this would add to the economic stability of Canada.
Whose economic stability? Well, the people's or the banks?
Everybody's. The Royal Bank, even though they wouldn't accept the 10 pounds of pot, they would be able to.
The Rothschilds, the Bilderbergers,
Well, no, but it would help everybody. Like, it has to be like a win-win situation, you know. And so if it solves all these social problems, you know, and if we can get these, you know, that if so and such and such happens, would the city council go along with it? Would the police board go along with it? Would they instruct the police not to enforce this?
Would they sell us guns for pot, Ian?
That's interesting. Would they sell
military equipment?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess we could trade the Canadian Army. Yeah, we could trade the Canadian Army for you know, because they're already smuggling it. I suppose we could do that. Or
we just need them to smuggle.
Well, they're talking about getting forming the CIA in Canada, or a CIA like organization in Canada. Why would anybody need more terrorists, right? You know, why would Canadians want their own terrorists? But maybe they're talking about having their own pot for guns as opposed to coke for guns equivalent.
Yeah. They downgrade it. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Hemp standard. Oh my god, that would be awesome. On the bills, like, instead of, you know.
Well, I think I actually should get that stamp up here so we can, like, start subversively stamping all the money at the.
And if you see this on money, though, you never do money, though, right?
Well,
deface the queen.
Well, you know what it could be is that when you stamp it, you can then put it into the underground economy as opposed to the overground economy, because as soon as it goes out of the overground, out of the underground economy, it gets gobbled up by the overground. As soon as they see the hemp standard, they'll take it out of circulation, they'll burn it. In fact, I was.
So then we use those bills only between ourselves.
Exactly.
Then
exactly.
We take them over. We deface them and make them ours.
Right.
It would still, our own value.
Yeah, and it would still be worth $50 or 5 hours, because it's a hemp standard.
The Cuny Barter Bulletin, like, in the old days, I was really like, that should be added in as whatever your local barter system is.
I've been thinking of writing a hemp standard article for the Kootenai barter system. That would probably be a good idea.
I think it would, because a lot of people are skeptical sometimes of barter systems, because there's no. But if you mix the two and you're like, buds, food, automotive, you know, and then you could say Barter Bulletin can do the same thing. You, like, get them all mixing together so people can understand.
Like, yeah, I think it's like within Nelson right now is like a vast, you know, huge, you know, gold bullion equivalent of unsold pot, is my understanding from what's out there. The Canadian Reserve
is here
in the
dug in the backyards of people.
Exactly, in poly tubes everywhere. And there's gold, green gold in them there are hills, and how do we take advantage of it, you know? And
there's gold in them there's hills.
Yeah, and so what I think it's a psychological trick, because currencies are essentially confidence games. You know, you have a piece of paper and somebody says, hey, that's worth, you know, X XY. And you go, oh, you know, and you look at the U.S. back, there's a big army to back it, you know, and they have the propaganda machine going. You know that it's, you know, even though the one-third of U.S. currency outside the U.S. is counterfeited in Czechoslovakia, you know it's still good, you know.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, and the Americans like the Czechoslovakian counterfeit because it saves the money. And so it's a confidence game. And The local employment trading system that started in Courtney in 93, by a fellow named Michael Linton, started it up with actually money from an old SoCred. And the social credit party was based earlier on the social credit system, which was, in a sense, the bastard grandfather of the local employment trading system, because they assigned social credits to everyone, and based on person's social credits, they would get a cash equivalent, essentially, that from which they could spend money in the economy. And because it was government backed, when they tried this in Alberta, it actually worked.
It worked, yeah. Alberta, and if, like, people think of Alberta as this super conservative thing, well, the social credit system was in there.
Yeah, because the financial system had only been in place since the 1870s at that point, and so the issuing of money by a government body was like a still a fairly new thing, and so the social credit system was a more advanced version of this, and but the Canadian government came down hard on the social credit government and made them stop. But the social credit party that came into power based on the social credit remained in power in Alberta until the 1960s and was in power in BC until the 1980s. But everybody forgot about what the social credit system meant. But essentially you get the same thing with the local employment trading system, except it's even more ingenious in that it tends to build more green dollars. You tend to have an excess of green dollars that you can't spend anywhere, as opposed to a constant musical chairs deficit of federal dollars.
See, another thing too is that with the hemp standard, everybody's backyard is a printing press.
Exactly. You know, and so it works along fine. And it's like, no matter where you are, whether it's the North Pole or whether it's Addis Ababa, a gram, a good pod, will always be worth $10. Whereas gold, like what are you going to do with gold? Melt it into a ring? You know, they're not using it industrially too much anymore. It's lost its value. But cannabis, it's medicine, it's, you know,
food, clothing, yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah. And so as a potential evolutionary as opposed to revolutionary act, it's it could be quite powerful. And using a political party structure, such as the Marijuana Party, I was thinking that you could have a rave where you go in like a political party, essentially. This is what I was wanting to do with the mm-hmm. dance party. So I'm going to go in and plunk down their 5 grams or $50 and get these the equivalent in barter currency, either in a smart card or a dollar system, and you could then trade for your tested ecstasy, and you could buy your, you know, grade A certified marijuana within the party, vote for the legalization of marijuana once more within the party, and see that coming over the LED below the main DJ as you're dancing, and so that you know that if you're A to F, then you can go and you can vote from issue 1 to 2 to 3 in your voting dealing booth. So I designed a booth that you could fit 8 people, would fit onto a folding table, and would have essentially a voting booth, but built into it you'd have like a weighing booth, you'd have like a little slot that you move up between people to actually do your negotiations, you'd have, you know, you'd have all your stuff for...
And people would be voting as they went to each booth.
Exactly.
Because they would be buying it with their card, which would have... That would be kind of the currency for the rave.
Exactly. And that way, if you chose to be as above, then you can pay taxes on it. Or as so below, you don't have to participate in that system at all. And so the you have consumer protection, you have the group participation, you have ability to collect taxes, you have harm reduction,
yeah, regulation, safety,
you have a general benefit to the community, and you have within the protected space of a political party meeting. And on top of that, that $50 that you originally put in to boost up the reserves you already would have going into the system if you were already a member of the party and already had the your hemp standard green bucks, you could on the $50 you or 50 green bucks or 50 federal dollars or whatever that you put in to get 50 additional more green bucks. That would qualify as a political tax deduction as well. And so there you go. You can have your revolution, evolution, get your pot, do your dancing, have your liberation, and boost the economy of Nelson through the hemp standard and the barker buck.
And there's some room there, like to get smoothies and...
it could be perfect. It could be a beautiful community event with it being on a on that sort
There's
of training basis.
There's lots of it about.
Plenty.
Apparently
that's a CD that's skipping. Oh, no,
that's
an
LP.
No, that's an LP.
Cannabis, that is.
Green
cannabis?
Freedom. Liberty.
Beautiful people.
My cat was doing that today as well. We can't get away from the land of plenty. Okay, I guess it's our albumancy for the evening. The random scratch that's appeared.
That means.
So there you go, the hemp stand.
We
should get that going.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
And we need that stampion.
I'll phone tomorrow and...
You're going to call your Yugoslavian connection?
No, the Victoria connection, my old store, because they would have a box. I might even have it, I'm not sure. But yeah, they'll probably have it somewhere. I don't think they've been using it, so they'll be happy to send it up. But yeah, I was actually told by the Royal Bank, stop stamping that money, please. You know, and
really,
but they couldn't do anything. Rick Gibson, who is a kind of performance artist of the 1980s, who I was audio archiving for a while for Vancouver Cooperative Radio, who was actually most famous for Sniffy the Rat, like publicly stating that he would kill a rat for art, and creating an international uproar and riot as a result of his attempts to kill this rat called Sniffy. Also came up with Rub Out the Queen. When the $2 bill was being phased out, he went down Robinson Street with 200 or 100 $2 bills, followed by a television camera, and would ask people, or would give people these $2 bills if they would say what could go on the Queen's face instead of the Queen. And then he would white out the Queen and give them to people to do this. And so, because it turned out that he did that because under the Banking Act, anybody can deface the currency. You just can't shave off like a dime and like make another silver dollar out of shaved off dimes, which is what people have done. That's bad according to the Canadian government. You can do that. But anyways, but then that's kind of the silly aspects of. Getting back to the confidence game of, you know, what are these like little objects and this money? It's all based on the premise of scarcity. And the whole thing about the local employment trading system, as it's based on the premise of plenty, which is why the Egyptian economy with the grain standard worked so well, because that's why the Bass temples were so huge, where the cats would come from, because the cats would protect the temples that.